Vietnam has spelled tragedy. Tragedy for the victims of this senseless war. Tragedy for all of Southeast Asia. The war has been fought. The war has despoiled the countryside, the farm, and the jungle. Tragedy for this nation, whose polity it has divided. Tragedy for the world, whose interests it has preoccupied, when there were far more pressing problems for all to be concerned with. The majority of the American people have wanted to be quit of Vietnam for a number of years. To the credit of the American people, or at least to the majority of them, as soon as they saw the consequences of this involvement, they began to clamor for withdrawal, for an end. Certainly this was at least part of the significance of the elections of 1968. Certainly this is what the Gallup and other polls have been revealing to us in increasing proportions in the last months and years. Certainly this is what our own conversations, our own knowledge of others, our neighbors and friends would indicate. And the president has understood the temper of the American people. He has not denied it. In fact, in the last address to Congress dealing with our foreign affairs, trying to explain his policies in Southeast Asia, he wrote of their initiation and included this phrase: "The support of the American people during the remainder of the conflict required a diminishing United States involvement." The president, for reasons of principle, as reasons for quite personal reasons, wants to be out of Vietnam. There are only two issues in which he can lose the next election. One is the issue of the economic health of the nation. The other is the issue of the war in Vietnam, casualty lists, and inflation. And the two are intertwined, interlinked. For it is the over $200 billion which we have poured into that Asian mud, which has to the largest degree unbalanced our economy, and brought about the present straitened circumstance. $200 billion. I did a little arithmetic the other day. If in 1960 we had given to every man, woman, and child in South Vietnam, in North Vietnam, in Cambodia, and in Laos $50,000, we would have spent less money in Southeast Asia than we have spent on war. And imagine the hospitals that could have been built, the roads which could have been laid, the agricultural and irrigation projects which could have been undertaken. $50,000 for every man, woman, and child. Or if we had taken the same $200 billion and given it to the families in America who represent the other America, the poor, those who live below the poverty line, we could have given $250,000, $250,000 to every such family, and still have spent less of our national treasure. Imagine the decent housing we could have raised. Imagine the kinds of schooling we could have provided. Imagine the kinds of deprivation we could have undone. Instead of this, we find ourselves, because of the budget, because of a war budget, because of 15 years of war budgets, we found ourselves cutting back on minimal welfare support, cutting back on public housing, cutting back on all the programs of the Office of Economic Opportunity, cutting back on educational and medical research, cutting back on all those things which make for the vitality and the vigor and the health of the nation. Vietnam is a disaster. The question is, what do we do about it? How do we get out? Many of us have become so frustrated. The war has lasted so long. The policies which have been undertaken by successive governments, Republican, Democratic, and Republican, policies have been so inimical to what we would have wanted that we, in a sense, have turned off, tuned out. There are a lot of people I know, there are a lot of people whom you know, who whenever the news comes on, flicks the news off, who skip the black headlines from Southeast Asia, who out of sight is somehow out of mind. We don't want any part of this ongoing guilt, ongoing burden, ongoing frustration. It's too much for us. And many of us have become almost paranoid in our reactions about Vietnam. We have come to look upon successive administrations as the devil incarnate. We've come to assume that every one of their undertakings is Machiavellian, mischievous, shrewd, diabolic. What they propose in all areas we have come to instinctively deny. We have reacted with our passions rather than with our intelligence. Though, as you know, I fundamentally and totally believe that we have been misguided in every action we have taken in Southeast Asia, I submit to you that a kind of naive pacifism is not wisdom, but the absence of policy. That a bumper sticker, another family for peace, is a bumper sticker, and not a conceived, calculating, reasonable, realistic foreign policy. And a naive isolationism would be one of the worst disasters which could come out of Southeast Asia. The president said in his report to Congress just 2 days ago that he saw in being forces in America which would sweep us towards an isolationism which would be as disastrous as excessive zeal. And in that, I agree with him. The American people have somehow come to believe that the world is different than the world really is. That if only America would cease being so belligerent, so malicious, so imperialistic, if only we would withdraw from wherever we have commitments, then somehow all of the problems of the world would drain away. The only guilt which exists in the world is our guilt. Now, we have guilt aplenty. But there is guilt to be shared because there is greed in every nation. The world survives not because the nations of the world want peace, but because there is a balance of terror between the nations. Yes, there is a lesson in Southeast Asia, but there is also a lesson in the Middle East. Yes, there is a lesson in Cambodia, but there is also a lesson in Czechoslovakia. And Munich did take place. I believe we have drawn the line at the wrong place in the wrong part of the world for the wrong reasons. But lines must be drawn. We do not live in a world where everyone out there is saintly and we alone are the devil. We live in a world of grasping, greedy nations, each trying to take advantage commercially, militarily, in terms of balance of power of all other nations. We must never forget this. It may not be the world we would want to live in. It may not be the world we want to leave to our children, but this is the world. We can't blink it away. No amount of moralism, pietism, simplistic pacifism will allow us to change the nature of the world. When a weak animal is blooded, the hounds redouble their effort. The president is right when he says that this nation must be very careful to remind itself always that there are commitments, freedom, defense to oneself, which cannot be gainsaid, and which must be honored. I'm not prepared for all of my adamant opposition to the president's policies in Vietnam to blink away two statements he made. I do not believe that he is Machiavellian only. I believe him when he says, I want to end the war to save the lives of the brave young men in Vietnam. And I believe him when he tries to explain his policy in terms of the continuing commitments of the United States. I want to end it in a way which will increase the chance that their younger brothers and their sons will not have to fight in some future Vietnam someplace in the world. I simply believe that he's applying the logic to the wrong place, drawing the wrong line. I find myself, in short, often protesting the war among those whose protests are not taken on the same basis as mine. Those who are opposed to all American commitments anywhere in the world. And I do believe that the greatest power in the world has commitments in Western Europe. And has commitments in the Middle East, and has commitments in Latin America. Commitments which must be honored. Commitments to those weaker, yet who are aligned with us in common purpose and common value. My own feeling about Vietnam is that we ought to have followed in Vietnam the example that General de Gaulle set for us when he withdrew the French from Algeria. The French, you remember, fought the National Liberation Front of the Algerians for some 8 years. It was a bloody war. It drained France's economy. France was being ticked off as no longer a great power. It was a third-rate power. Then General de Gaulle came into office and he looked at the situation. He saw that the half of the French army was involved in Algeria. He saw how much of the French treasure was being forced to drown that desert drain. And he cut French losses in Algeria overnight. He announced withdrawal. He turned the withdrawal, the retreat of French troops, into a logistic triumph. He negotiated with the National Liberation Front of the Algerians the withdrawal peacefully, the exodus of the colons, the French nationals, some of whom had lived in Algeria for two, three, four, and more generations. And at the end of that tunnel, French economy was buoyant. France was able to again to become a major power. La gloire, the glory that de Gaulle thought so much of and which he has peddled around the world, became again a possibility to the French nation. And interestingly, France began to earn dollars from Algeria, from its commercial enterprises, not to throw away francs, dollars, in Algeria as heretofore. I believe that this ought to have been our policy in Vietnam once we saw the disastrous consequences of our involvement. The only argument I have heard against such a policy would be that so many of our allies would be slaughtered if the Viet Cong and the National Liberation Front and North Vietnamese marched into Saigon. Perhaps. The blood has flown in Southeast Asia for 25 years. And the streets have been bloody during all of those 25 years. And I somehow suspect that if we really wanted to, we could negotiate with Hanoi about the removal of our minions and puppets from that part of the world and move them safely to these shores. The president has argued, and argued consistently since he has come into office, not against this policy of unilateral withdrawal, and he has spoken of winding down the war, of easing ourselves out. His arguments have taken generally this form. I take this from his report of 2 days ago, but he has spoken in this way in many occasions. Others, he wrote, urge that we liquidate our presence immediately, cut our losses, and leave the Vietnamese on their own. He reads me very well. I have repeatedly explained why I consider this a disastrous path. For the South Vietnamese people would have lost their collective political choice and countless individual lives. For other non-communist countries, especially in Asia, among whom not a single leader recommended such a policy. For the global credibility of the U.S. word. For those Americans who have made such heavy sacrifices. And for the integrity of American security in the post-Vietnam era. I understand his logic, but I must confess that I reject it. He argues that we ought to wind down the war, not to withdraw, for the South Vietnamese people, who could have lost their collective political choice and countless individual lives. When have the South Vietnamese people had a collective free political choice? Yes, they have lost countless individual lives, but I submit to you that the Vietnamization of the war will guarantee only that they will lose countless more individual lives. But what is it but the policy that the casualty list shall be of Vietnamese corpses rather than of American corpses? Yes, I can understand him when he says, for other non-communist countries, especially in Asia, among whom not a single leader recommended such a policy. But I would submit that the policies recommended by South Korea, Thailand, and Philippines, are minions and puppets, hardly represent the sum and the burden of the advice which has been given to the West by the free world. What are the leaders in Europe saying? What do some of the free world leaders in Latin America say? That America's involvement in Southeast Asia has precluded America's involvement in their problems, and we have lacked the money, we have lacked the clout, we have lacked the will to maintain the forces of NATO adequately. We have lacked the money, we have lacked the will to maintain the ties of economic reform and the infusion of our monies into Latin America so much needed. And that because of our preoccupation in Southeast Asia, the free world, as it has been traditionally defined, is the weaker, not the stronger. Yes, I can understand the president when he says, for other non-communist countries, and especially in Asia, among whom not a single leader recommended such a policy, but I submit that Thailand and the Philippines and South Korea ought not to determine what our policy shall be. It's good for them, but not necessarily good for the free world. What about for the global credibility of the United States' word? When is one's word as a nation creditable? When one can act to meet one's commitments. When so much of American wealth and so much of American weaponry and so much of the American army is tied down in Vietnam, what do we have left elsewhere in the world to make our word creditable? Why has the Russian Navy moved unopposed into the Mediterranean? Why has the Russian Navy moved almost unopposed into the South Atlantic? Because we lack the capability to operate on two fronts effectively because of Southeast Asia. The credibility of our word depends on our ability to support the free nations of the world. And we have lacked the flexibility because all of our energies, all of our concern, so much of our treasure was involved in that one little part. What about for those Americans who have made such heavy sacrifices? Sacrifice life is tragic. 45,000 Americans have died. Will they be resurrected by the sacrifice of more lives? How does one honor the sacrifice of the dead? By maintaining the values of the nation. And is our nation united, whole, strong, of one mind, of common purpose? Or has, in fact, Vietnam split us apart? The warring camps, who are so preoccupied each with its own individual aims that there lacks any sense in this nation of ours today of common overarching purpose. Where is the trust we once implicitly had in our government that somehow it would muddle through internationally and lead us domestically? That, too, has been washed out in the dirty linen of Southeast Asia. I'm afraid that I must respectfully suggest to our president that though I can understand the logic of his position, I do not believe it ties in with the realities of America or the world today. Southeast Asia represents tragedy. And his policy of winding down the war in Southeast Asia represents, I would respectfully submit, potentially greater tragedy than any we have seen heretofore. Because the president's policy for winding down the war, rather than from simply withdrawing, requires two elements. The first, negotiation, Paris, peace talks. And what have we offered at these peace talks? We would withdraw from Southeast Asia, provided the North Vietnamese would withdraw from South Vietnam. What we insisted upon from beginning to end was the viability of something called South Vietnam. We insisted that South Vietnam must be a nation. Lo haya, lo nivra. It never was. It was never intended to be. But somehow this has become an idée fixe, a fixed idea, a requirement of our policy. The one requirement, of course, in which the North will not negotiate. Negotiations have failed. We attempted and are attempting a policy which is called Vietnamization. Now, Vietnamization appeals to the American people. It seems to speak of a nation defining itself, assuming responsibilities for its own national destiny. And it has had one glorious effect, which the president never ceases to remind us of, and that it has permitted the president to reduce our troop commitments in Southeast Asia from 548,000 2 years ago to some 320,000 today, supposedly to 286,000 by May 1st. And we have watched the casualty lists in Southeast Asia lower themselves from a level around 250 monthly in 1968 to 180 monthly in 1969, to 81 monthly in 1970, to 51 monthly in the last 6 months. Pressure within our country tended to diminish as draft calls went down and as casualty lists dropped. But there's a form of selective morality involved in all of this. What was the cost? During the same period when our draft calls were being reduced and our casualty lists were going down, we forced the South Vietnamese Army to raise its numbers by over 20%, from 900,000 men to 1,100,000 men. And as our casualty lists went down, their casualty lists over the last year have multiplied by fivefold. We haven't reduced the number of the dead. We simply have reduced the nationality of the dead. Vietnamization meant simply that we bought corpses. We said, we will continue to give you support. We are with you in your effort. We will buy the soldiers. We will give you all the air and tactical and machinery support you require. But you now must slug it out on the ground. You who will attack when the attack moves into Laos. In order to provide the cover for the policy of Vietnamization, it was obvious that the United States would have to shelter the Vietnamese forces as they had never been sheltered before. If our combat troops were to be withdrawn, our air umbrella would have to be increased. Well and good. But it soon became obvious that we had to buy more time than just that. We had somehow to cut, to interdict the supply lines of the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese into South Vietnam. And so about a year ago, just in February of last year, we recalled that it was suddenly revealed to the American people that when we had ceased bombing in North Vietnam, we had simply moved the bombers and the fighter bombers over into Laos, and that we were now operating some 500 to 1,000 missions a day against the Ho Chi Minh Trail. The little panhandle of Laos, whose geography has suddenly appeared in our papers these last weeks, has had more bombs dropped upon it than any other piece of real estate on the face of the globe. And still, 1,000 trucks a day move down those trails. We began to move our bombing elsewhere into Southeast Asia to increase the ambit of the war in order to protect our own troops, so the president said, but actually in order to protect the emerging forces of the South Vietnamese. And then in April of 1970, when suddenly the Cambodian government was overthrown and Lon Nol's government was introduced, We moved American and South Vietnamese forces into the so-called sanctuaries just across the South Vietnamese borders in Cambodia, again to cut the southern half of the Ho Chi Minh Trail, more importantly, to prevent supplies from coming in from Sihanoukville on the coast directly to the North Vietnamese troops. And thirdly, we moved in the last weeks north and east. We moved into Laos in order there to cut those forces. I'm not a strategist. I don't know whether these undertakings were successful or they were not successful. The president claims that particularly the move into Cambodia was a success, that it cut the southern supply lines into the Mekong Basin area of South Vietnam and therefore freed the South Vietnamese soldiers who were in southern Vietnam to move north for this present undertaking. I simply don't know. I do know that the rate of casualties in Southeast Asia has not been reduced. I do know that where a year and a half ago there were North Vietnamese enclaves just outside the South Vietnamese border in Cambodia. Today, North Vietnamese troops range across two-thirds of Cambodia, that only the capital seems for the moment to be safe, and that the South Vietnamese who were to be withdrawn when our troops are withdrawn remain in Cambodia because only they maintain the river supply line to the capital and the route which runs from the capital to the sea. And I do know that in Laos, we seem to be bogged down. We have not yet begun to move against the major parts of the trail, and more than this, I do know that in Laos, where the puppet Lao, the North, the communists have operated with relative ease in one half of the country which they control, they have, for reasons best known to them, maintained a balance of power and not attacked Vientiane, the administrative capital, and not attacked Phnom Penh, the provincial capital, the big cities, but that they could do so at will and that they may do so now. And I do know the massive air cover which we have provided in Cambodia and in Laos does not seem to be achieving the victory with honor that the president seems to want. We have tried every kind of strategy and tactic in that part of the world. Each time, we have pulled up short. Because in military parlance, there is always a response, ultimately, to every attack that you make. What concerns me most is that now we have governed our actions by a Cooper Church Amendment, congressional rules representing the will of certainly the majority of the American people that our ground forces not be involved in these attacks, that we are finding ways around this kind of restriction. We are bending it. Our administration is bending it every way it can. We'll send in massive air support. We'll send in the helicopters. The helicopters are down. We'll send in combat patrols in order to bring out our own downed flights. But what happens if it all fails? What happens if we must precipitously pull out all of the South Vietnamese from Cambodia and from Laos, if in fact the North Vietnamese troops gain the upper hand? What happens then to our ground involvement in South Vietnam and beyond its borders? And more than this, the president was asked 10 days ago, his press conference, were there any limits to the defense of the withdrawing American troops in Southeast Asia? His answer was that we would not engage ground troops outside of South Vietnam, but that there were really no limits to the engagement of our air power. He reminded the man who asked him, the reporter, that he had told publicly and privately the North Vietnamese that if they did not show increased infiltration, we would not show increased aerial response, but that they had spurned this kind of give and take, and that we were prepared to do all that was necessary in order to defend our forces as they withdrew. And then he went on to say, he wanted to make special reference to a particularly irresponsible statement made by Hans Morgenthau, professor from the University of Chicago, in which he had spoken of the possibility of using tactical atomic weapons in Southeast Asia. The United States did not contemplate such use and would not use them. He dismissed this suggestion out of hand. We've all long since learned when a president cites a columnist in a give and take, he has taken that columnist seriously. That columnist has made a suggestion which cuts close to the bone. And I began to try and research this suggestion. Hans Morgenthau, in an article in the New Republic of February 1920 called What Price Victory, tried to analyze the possible alternative for American action in Southeast Asia. He assumed that we would not win on the ground with our own, with South Vietnamese troops, what we could not win with our own troops. So he asked, what alternatives are possible? He said there are three. The first alternative is unilateral withdrawal, the Algerian plan, and that the president has refused to accept. The second alternative is to so enrage the Chinese, to force the Chinese to attack through North Vietnam, which would unify the American people and create a global war in which the home front would be involved with a massive enemy. And this, he says, is rejected throughout the administration. The third response would be the response of trying to step up the effectiveness of our air power, and only one weapon is left in our arsenal, that of tactical atomic weapons. Tactical atomic weaponry, which sounds so neat and so clean, can be defined very simply. The bomb which was dropped at Hiroshima would today be classified as a tactical nuclear weapon. We would so destroy the countryside, we would so pollute the air with atomic fallout that, in a sense, no life could subsist under this kind of attack. We would be able to seal off South Vietnam from enemy attack, and therefore give the South Vietnamese the time that they require. Now, had Hans Morgenthau imagined all of this in his fertile mind? Not at all. I went back and I reminded myself that I had read of this suggestion earlier, and I discovered that on November 12th, C.L. Sulzberger, reporting from Southeast Asia, from Saigon, spoke of a high-level briefing which he attended, at which the generals present discussed the possibility and feasibility of tactical nuclear weaponry. They dismissed it. But obviously, it's on the table. It's in the air. And there are very other few alternatives left. The present alternative of South Vietnamese ground forces and a massive American air power fails to achieve our undertaking. Southeast Asia is a tragedy. What can we do but sit, keen, wail, and lament our fate? There are times when that's all we can do. The administration has embarked on one course. We will have an opportunity, a year and a few months, to vote out an administration if it has failed to make good on this course. There are very few alternatives to pressure the government. There are alternatives of desperation, demonstration. They seem to have little long-range effect. Many in America are satisfied with Vietnamization. The reverse of it is the Cooper Church Amendment, because both of these undertakings limit our own death, limit the cost to the American people. The president can get up and say to an audience, I have reduced the cost of war to you by one half. He said that 3 days ago, from $22 billion to $11 billion. Assume the mathematics has been fudged, there's still a reduction in the cost of the war. He can get up and he can say, I have reduced troop levels in Southeast Asia by nearly a half. And I have reduced casualties in Southeast Asia, our casualties, 5 times. And all this is true. But there is the enlargement of the war. There's the vortex into which we are, the whirlpool, into which we are being sucked in Laos and in Cambodia. There are even noises about an attack north across the demilitarized zone into North Vietnam. Does it end? Can it end? We are determined to have peace and honor, peace and victory, the kind of double goal which the president has set for us. I don't believe it can be achieved. I don't believe that there is any alternative now, nor has there been for some years, except for the American people to stand up and look at the mirror and say to themselves, we have finally lost a war. We have been defeated by one of the smallest nations on the face of the earth. We undertook something we should never have undertaken. We have no alternative now but to withdraw and to regroup and to define new national priorities. Yes, defeat. But that's the last thing a proud people, a vainglorious people, wants to admit. The world has known many a bitter time. I suppose that there have been more bitter times in our lifetime, the lifetime of men, than happy times. I wish I could come before you and say, here is a simple blueprint. Let's do this. Let's vote for this man. Let's organize this party. Suddenly all will be right. We voted in one party, we voted out that party, we voted it in again. The more it changes, the more it's the same thing. I wish I could say to you that obstinate, obdurate demonstration against the force of the government is the way. We've had these demonstrations over the last 5 or 6 years, and they have not proven to have the force. We can mass millions of people in protest. Foreign policy is the prerogative of the administration. The Congress has been willing to go along with the president as long as the president was reducing our own costs and our own lives. It's not easy, not a happy thing to be an American today, to bear a large measure of guilt. We're burdened, freighted, the great sense of unhappiness. What shall we do? Keep clear what must be done. Not never substitute passion for intelligence. Speak what must be spoken. Retain the courage of our convictions. Remind ourselves constantly that every life is precious. Yellow-skinned, black-skinned, and white-skinned. And that because it is the yellow-skinned man who is dying in Southeast Asia in largest numbers today, does not mean that there is any less guilt on our part for these tragic events. Someone said that there's a light at the end of every tunnel. A correspondent by the name of Halberstam said the other day that at the end of every tunnel in South Vietnam, there's another tunnel. We come from a people who have lived underground, behind walls, and in tunnels. We have found that the day, the night, years may be long, dark, somehow there is a light. We must not lose faith in that light. But I cannot tell you when it will come. And I cannot tell you that the cost of lives may not be very high.